Which queen among us doesn't dream of being thrust into the realm of legend, where our name is remembered long after we're gone? So who's gonna be around to tell your tale in the future? The haters or the ones who you loved and nurtured?
For Courtney Barringers, a black drag queen from the small town of Albany, Georgia, who died from complications from AIDS back in the mid-2000s, it's her nephew, Terry Guest, who tells her tale in his new play, At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen.
Today, playwright and star at the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen, Terry Guest, and his co-star, Paul Michael Thompson, join us to talk about bringing back Terry's deceased drag queen uncle, Courtney Barringers, and her gal pal, Vicky Versailles, back to life in this innovative play. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Our guest today is playwright and star of the new production, At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen, here in Chicago, Terry Guest. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Terry.
Woo.
Also joining us is the co-artistic director and co-star of the play, Paul Michael Thompson.
Hey, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for coming on to Feast of Fun.
Thanks for being here, guys.
This play is a funeral. It's a wake for a drag queen. Terry, that's based on your real life uncle.
Yeah.
Courtney.
Yeah. So his name is Anthony Knighton. His drag name was Courtney Barringers. Mm-hmm. And that's also his drag name on the show. And the show, well, I started writing it really years ago. My uncle died in 2015 or 16. And it really impacted me because he was the only other queer person that I knew personally. And right before he died, we had a conversation where he came out to me and I asked him if he thought he was going to go to heaven or hell. And he told me he thought he was going to go to hell. And that just, can I say fuck?
Yeah, of course.
That fucked me up. So I thought after he died, okay, I got to do something with this. I got to write something. When I was in high school and I was like, oh, I'm going to write a musical. It's going to be just like Chicago. then I grew out of that and I was in high school and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to write this play. It's going to be just like, you know, Fences or whatever. And just like August Osage County. And I never actually wrote it. And then I moved to Chicago and it was cold and sad and I was lonely and it was snowy and I had just like nothing to do. I was just listening to Adele all the time. And I started writing it. And
so, Terry, your uncle's drag name was Courtney Barringers. That's why it's mm-hmm. so specific, because I was looking at this and I was like, that's very unusual for a drag name.
Yeah, I think, well, Courtney, I don't know where that came from, but sure. Barringers is the name of his favorite wine. So that's where Courtney Barringers comes from. Yeah.
Was it hard? A lot of drag queens named after booze. That's
right. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Was it hard to lose your uncle?
Yeah. I mean,
you were close to him.
Yeah, I was really close to him. Uh-huh. And like I said, he was the only other queer person that I really knew personally. So it was scary.
Now, did you know him as a drag queen?
Yeah. Growing up, I like saw him doing drag. I never saw him perform, actually, unfortunately, because I was a kid. But yeah, I knew that he was a drag queen. I've seen pictures of him. I saw him in drag. And honestly, when I was a little kid, it scared me.
Yeah. It should.
Yeah. Was she a pretty queen?
Yeah, she was beautiful. She was tall, y'all. She was tall. In heels, she was like pushing 7 foot.
Oh, wow. She was a tall, skinny black drag queen from the South.
Yes.
Like RuPaul.
Yeah, but not nearly as rich or famous.
When did Courtney pass? What year are we talking here?
I think it was 2015.
Okay, so not too long ago.
Yeah. Or 2005. I'm sorry. I'm a liar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. 2005.
Because I'm like, you were saying you were in high school. I was kind of confused.
Yes. No. Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, 2005.
Okay. All right.
So this is before sort of the drag race revolution or the renaissance, right?
Yeah.
And in your family and your community, like, what did they think of Courtney? Did they think like she was sort of like this exotic creature, that she was sort of like foolhardy? Did they think of drag as a legitimate career?
Did they think of drag as a legitimate career? Yeah. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, I think before RuPaul's Drag Race, not many people thought of drag as a legitimate career. Mm-hmm. And especially in Albany, Georgia, like, no. Drag was her creative outlet. Her career was survival. You know, she did whatever job she could do to make it. And then she spent whatever money she had left over to create. And that was for herself. Drag was for her. My family, they were pretty supportive. Like, my aunt and my mom got to see her perform. I don't know that my grandmother ever did. She's a Jehovah's Witness, so... but she... Thankfully, we didn't ever have a situation of people, like, kicking him out of the house or, you know, not letting him around or anything like that.
Did Courtney live by herself or did she live with somebody?
No, she lived in a house with a gaggle of queens.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How old were you when you sort of started seeing your uncle dressing up in drag, you know, because you didn't go to the clubs, obviously.
No, my earliest memory of him dressing in drag, I was a very little kid. And like I said, it scared the shit out of me. And then I kind of don't really remember much about it until I was maybe 14 or 15. And my parents would start to, like, let me see pictures or, you know, but I knew that something, even though it was never spoken to me about until right before he died, I knew that there was something fishy about him. You know, like I knew that there was something. There was something
so
about him.
So when you told your parents, like, hey, I'm going into theater, you know, and they're just like, oh, no, here it comes again.
Not, you know, my parents had such a little reference for theater. I don't even think they thought of it as a gay thing. Yeah. I think that my parents just thought of theater as, like, weird white folks. You know, like, they were like,
it still is.
I think they were more afraid that I was just going to be like one of those black kids that straighten their hair. No shade to black kids.
So, Paul, and you're the co-artistic director.
I am. Yeah.
Of the what is it? The story theater. Story theater.
Yeah.
And so tell us about how it was sold, the idea of doing basically a 2-person show where you guys pay to have a wake for a drag queen.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we at The Story have a program called the Emerging Playwright Residency Program. And so we had an application process. We're just in our second season. So we had kind of a rousing first season of successes. And so we opened this residency application to all local Chicago playwrights. We got a lot of submissions. We narrowed it down to semifinalists and then 2 finalists. Terry was one of them. We interviewed them all. We talked about their play and also a new play that they'd like to develop. And it was very clear to us at The Story that this play was something that's really special. And, you know, Terry was talking about that before RuPaul's Drag Race, there wasn't as much access to drag culture. But now, because of things like Drag Race and YouTube, you know, there's so much access to drag queen culture. And, you know, even people who are not in queer culture are beginning to engage with queer culture in different ways. So this play seemed to be coming at just the right time where we could explore these themes of, you know, friendship and death and racism in the play is something that is a theme that is explored and the disparities of race in the South, that we could explore all of these themes through the lens of drag and have it be super accessible to people. Because for the first time, it seems like drag is becoming a part of mainstream culture.
And drag is magical realism. You know?
Exactly. And so is the play.
So much like the Candy's episode in Pose, you know, Courtney comes to life, which is played by you, Terry.
Yes.
And reads people to filth.
So, God, let's talk about Candy's episode in Pose. First off, I love Pose. Ryan Murphy, hi, if you're listening. When I saw that episode, I was like, "Dah!" Because there are so many similarities between the way that I see the world and the way that the creators of that show see the world. And that's what I love so much about it. And but I think that this play is doing something that Pose is not doing, and that Pose takes place in New York City. And if you look at so many of the queer stories, so many of the especially stories that have to do with HIV and AIDS, they take place in the 80s and the 90s, and they take place in New York City or San Francisco. However, there is an epidemic that's happening right now today in the rural South with black people and brown people, where they are dying at incredible numbers. And we don't have things like Pose, you know, yet. And so part of my mission is to tell that very specific story that you can't really find in Angels in America, and you can't find in Love, Valor, Compassion, and you can't find in Pose.
It's but, Southern, it's queer, it's Black.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the show, too, uses that lens to teach us so much. So both of our characters, so it's only a two-person play. Terry and I are the two people in it, and both of our characters are living with HIV. But my character, Vicky, who is obviously a white person, because I'm a white person, is undetectable and is on a tripla and has been for a year, and is living with HIV in a very different way than Terry's character, Courtney, is living with and eventually dies from complications due to HIV and AIDS. And so the play explores that epidemic that Terry is talking about that is happening in the South. And it's set contemporary. It's set right now.
What's the relationship between Vicky and Courtney? So there's two drag queens.
Yes, there are.
Okay. So you're like looking at her and it's like, I'm still alive, you bitch.
No, not quite.
Not quite. But you know, that's a good line. Maybe I'll add it in.
Yeah.
You know,
friends,
we get to a little bit of both. We were just talking about how queer friendships, you know, are so special because there are so many blurred lines in many of those ways. And so our characters go through many different kinds of relationships, coworkers, friends, lovers at times. And we see that all in flashbacks from before Courtney has died. How would you describe our relationship in the play?
Terry?
I would say that the characters' relationships are complicated in the way, like Paul was saying, in the way that so many queer relationships can be. I know that I've had friends that I have, you know, argued with, fucked, hugged, cuddled with. But as far as we're both concerned, we're like just regular homies, you know? So I think that the best way to really figure their relationship out, because we're in rehearsals and we still aren't figuring
we're still
it out,
learning that.
So is to come see the show September 5th through the 22nd at the Raven Theater.
And that's this is a At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen.
Yeah, At the Wake of a Dead. The title is long, so I will say it again. At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen.
And not the funeral.
Not the funeral.
Why is it a wake? Explain to me the difference between the two.
Well, a funeral is where you come to see the dead body and you cry. Awake is where you come afterwards to talk with the family and to eat and to dance and to share stories about that person's
life. So we don't have like a Sharon Needles moment where you come out of a coffin or anything like that?
No coffins.
Oh, man.
No Sharon
well,
Needles
no yet,
moments.
But we haven't, you know, the show's not open yet. So
true,
there's still
there
time. So you'll have to see.
Oh. Yeah, there might be a coffin.
Maybe
all.
Thank you for the artistic contribution.
Right, well, that's the thing. My mom went to high school with Terrence McNally.
Yes, yeah.
And one thing that sort of pressed upon me is that Terrence writes his plays right with the actors. It's very workshopped. It's very organic process. And a lot of people actually think of like playwriting as this sort of very unilateral process where the playwright shows up and says, all right, actors, memorize the script.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that way at all for you, Terry, is it?
Yeah, no. I mean, this play has gone through two readings and a workshop in Atlanta. It's had numerous rewrites. This is the world premiere. And the process has been about 2 years from this play being written to this play being on stage.
You and lost the play.
Yes.
The play was stolen from you in a car. And because you're old school, you wrote it like a diary. You didn't have it like backed up in digital form.
Yeah. Because I'm old school, because I'm an idiot. I write everything by hand. I still do it. And I had my script in my book bag and it got stolen out of a car. I was home to see Beyonce and it got stolen out of my friend's car. And I was devastated. I thought
in the parking lot of the stadium or something?
In the parking lot of a restaurant.
Okay.
I was having dinner with her before I went to go see the Queen.
So it was very high and very low evening for you.
Very high, very high. And very low. Yes, indeed.
And sometimes as a designer, and this happens a lot more than people realize, you're working on a project and Photoshop or illustrator crashes on you, mm-hmm. and you're just like, oh, this has happened, you know, when I'm editing video or audio, and you're just like, oh, kill me. Yeah. You know, you're just like, you almost want to walk away from
it. But what a story of resilience that first ever draft was stolen. And then 2 months later was the first ever reading of At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen. So Terry came home and out of his depression, rewrote the whole thing by memory. And that's the draft that eventually turned into the script that we're doing for production now.
Well, if I can give you a future tip, what our friend Matt does is he writes stuff like, if he comes up with a joke, he's a comedian, writes it into a book, and then he takes a photo of it and then mails it to himself. So he has a timestamp, and he's like, if I lose the book, I've still got the joke.
Yes. Brilliant. Well, but what I've started to do now is write things down, and then like a week I'll go and put it on the computer. Yeah.
But I think in the creative process of having that devastating effect, that tragedy, some really wonderful creative moments can arise from that.
Absolutely. I think that in deciding to rewrite the play, I felt so much less worried about it. I was like, well, you know, I already lost it once, so I'm just going to write everything that I remember and what it is will be. And it came so quickly. And then by the time it was done, it was just like, shit, I did it. I have a play now.
And the thing about this play that's so special is that, you know, as we said, the themes that it explores and the narrative that it's telling, specifically that we all know it is in some ways based on Terry's deceased uncle. All of those are really important reasons to why we chose it. But at the end of the day, the language is really beautiful. The writing is really smart. The jokes are funny. It's a really good play. So it's not only exploring mm-hmm. issues that are really relevant and important right now. It's also telling a narrative in a way that is really smart. And the writing, I mean, you should just know, I think the writing is so strong in this play.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
Yeah, of course.
Do you think that the relationship of drag queens sometimes can be vicious unnecessarily? Because this is a criticism actually Pose gets, and I'm wondering how this manifests itself into your work. They say that the Ryan Murphy episodes of Pose treat the gender nonconforming, the trans characters mm-hmm. as cartoons, where they're sort of tempted to characterize themselves and exaggerate themselves, mm-hmm. Especially with the character of Electra, mm-hmm. Abundance, you know. Mm-hmm. But with the episodes of Janet Mox and Lady J, mm-hmm. they tend to portray the character of Electra, Abundance, as more kinder and more rounded.
Absolutely. It's very clear that Ryan Murphy knows how to write a read, but that he doesn't know how to write a trans character with depth yet.
How are you navigating that? Because you're a cisgendered gay man.
Yes, I am. So I just have a different writing style. I don't write anything.
Are you saying you're nicer than Ryan Murphy?
I am not saying that I'm nicer than Ryan Murphy, but I'm just saying that I haven't met him. Sure, he's very nice. Hire me. But I'm just saying that him and I have very little in common in terms of the way that we write. Like his purpose is something different. He writes sort of melodrama. He writes grand gay soap opera, which is why we love him, like Feud, brilliant. However, I am writing something that is a little more mysterious, something that my goals are to ask questions about the way that we relate to one another. My goal is not so much to get a yes from the audience.
You know, it's interesting hearing you talking about your writing process, because it really reminds me a lot of Terrell Alvin McCraney, who wrote Moonlight.
Yeah, I see. That is a comparison that I would accept much more. I would love to be just like him. But
there's this interesting drive in a lot of Black gay writers, is this desire to not put everything out there in the open, to be more mysterious than other types of writers.
Well, I think there's also something at play here, which is that Terry's writing characters that are incredibly complicated. Uh-huh. So ambiguity does come out of that. You know, our mission statement for the Story Theater is to pose questions and not supply answers. And like Terry said, he's trying to explore questions with his characters. And so these characters are not as black and white as maybe other writers are writing. And well, I think, and also, that's why.
For, you know, if you look at Pose, they have already 3 seasons. They have these characters that they have, you know, 30, 40 episodes to deepen and to complicate. And we have an hour and a half.
And maybe so, less than.
Yeah. And so, We get to the shit faster and dirtier.
Sure.
in this play. And just to riff off of Terrell Evan McCraney, he is such an incredible influence to me. And I would love to be mentioned alongside him someday. But I also think that my work is different from his too, because my experience is different from his experience.
Well, yeah, but there is a, you know, interesting trends, like how, for example, like all, you know, drag queens today sort of define themselves very much about whether they're going to fit as Rue Girls or not.
Right.
And, you know, Moonlight was such a juggernaut in the cultural space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In its success. And I would say, like, Hamilton success is why, a big reason why theater companies are so excited and putting so much, investing so much energy and money into African-American creatives and queer people of color into their work.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's long overdue, I would say. And it's something like, it's such a breath of fresh air. It's like, it's so to the point that, like, we can't go back.
Right.
Well, and I think that these works have always existed. Mm-hmm. Black queer people have always been creating art. It's just been about who's been listening. You know what I mean? We're not giving voices to any of those community. We're just listening for the first time. And I think, like, providing a platform, you know, more mainstream, quote unquote, are providing platforms for these people to tell their stories for the first time.
Yeah, but I think it's a situation where you're putting in millions or not billions of dollars into films and plays that it's just at an unprecedented rate, right, that we just never really had.
Yeah, I think because yeah. More people are listening now, studios are starting to recognize, oh, it's not just that Terrell Evan McCraney is a brilliant writer, but it's also that Terrell Evan McCraney's brilliant writing will make money.
Bankable.
People will see it. Hamilton, the reason that shows that include hip hop are going to be produced more and more frequently isn't just because Hamilton was good. It's because Hamilton is a financial juggernaut. Or not. And I think that it's so exciting that people, you know, I just saw Hamilton a few days ago, and there were so many old white people there. Mm-hmm. And
that's theater, right?
Same when I saw it.
Astonishing. But
old white, rich white people getting jiggy with it to Hamilton. It's something worth seeing.
Yeah. No,
and honestly, I'm like, I know you're not understanding all those lyrics, Grandma.
No, there was this man in front of us who was like bobbing his head so hard. He was crying. I mean, he was really into it.
He was feeling it.
Yeah, he was feeling it.
What Toni Morrison said, it's like racism affects white people more than it does black people in that sense. You know, obviously the violence is not the same, but in terms of like the spiritual impact, it's really up to white people to solve it.
Right.
And she says, leave me out of it. I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's like, this is not a problem that I had anything to do with creating.
And it's not for you to solve. I mean, in some ways, you know, part of me is like, I think the power of theater is in opening hearts and minds and getting people to empathize with our lives.
Like theater and music and art, they're persuasive in a way that politics could never be.
And it was so funny. I think you said, Mark, that the you know, old white people in the audience, that's theater for you. And I think that's something that we at The Story are trying to change as well, in that if we are going to be presenting a black playwright directed by a black director,
Michael
Burke, amazing, and telling this story of a black drag queen, then why should we have an audience that is majority white, right? So we are trying to also diversify not only the stories that we're telling, but who are the people who are paying to see this show, who are the people that have access to this show, who are, you know, our prices for tickets are very low, because we're trying to make theater something that everybody can come see, that's accessible for everybody. You know,
I love that.
Who's funding it? I think that's another thing when we talk about what stories are we telling, right? What $1 billion movies are, well, who are your donors? If your donors are old white people, then that's the perspective that they're going to be looking for in the stories that are being told. Yeah. And so I think it's important not only to diversify the plays that we're choosing, the actors that we're choosing to be in those plays, the directors we're choosing, those are all very important to diversify as well. We also need to look at diversifying our audience base and reaching out. You know, we're doing on a week from tomorrow, Thursday the 22nd, we're doing a panel at the Hyde Park Arts Center on Blackness and creating in Chicago theater. And we're hoping to engage with a lot of people from Hyde Park, hopefully Black people who will want to come see this show and see themselves reflected on stage. So that's really important to me.
I think that's wonderful. What does it mean to die from AIDS in the modern day? Because in talking to people who are struggling with HIV today, there's this sentiment that people in the past used to have this idea that you're sort of a victim, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily a healthy way of looking at it. And now they're almost like, you should have known better, Blanche. Yeah.
Well, I think if we're looking at, I mean, and please hop in on this, but I think if we're looking at the racial disparity mm-hmm. between who is getting HIV and contracting HIV and AIDS at higher rates, it is unprecedented in that way. And so there's a very large disparity right now. You know, Black and brown men who have sex with men are getting HIV or make up more of a population in the HIV and AIDS community than demographically in the United States, right? So we have to look at why is that happening? Is there lack of education? Is there lack of access? You know, who are we in our sexual education in school? I didn't learn about AIDS growing up in Arizona.
Did you guys grow up here in Chicago?
I grew up in Puerto Rico.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, and we did have some kind of talk about AIDS, but of course that's when AIDS first happened. I had a teacher, my biology teacher, she was living with one of the other teachers, so she was mm-hmm. a lesbian. I went to a Catholic yes. school. Oh, and wow. I remember her talking about anal sex. And good. Kids kind of giggled and laughed, and she's just like, you know, you can giggle and laugh, but I have a lot of friends who really like it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And people are like, wow. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that she and the other, like, they're living together, they have to be left. Oh. Turns out they were.
But in terms of our generation, Mark, mm-hmm. in answering that question, I think for us, it changed the way we have sex with each other.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
And having access to PrEP and Truvada, you know, is starting to change the way people are having sex with each other again. Mm-hmm. Like, I very remember a friend of mine who, he was gorgeous, you know. He loved beautiful, young, blonde, muscular men, and he got HIV at a very young age. I picked him up from the clinic, and he was in my car weeping. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't want to die. I'm going to die. And I'm just, you know, like those scenes from Pose happened to me in real life, and it affected me in a way that I'm like still... It's when you listen to people who talk about their circumcision, you're like, you're not aware of the trauma. That's how deep it is. Mm. And that's what, when we're talking about social inequality and racism and injustice and access to healthcare, mm-hmm. raising the minimum wage into a livable wage that stays in sync with inflation.
Yes.
These kind of things are impacting us in a way we're not even conscious of.
Right.
Well, and we see programs like Howard Brown Health, right, who have we have talked to and are hoping to partner with to get some information provided for this show so that people have mm-hmm. Access to education if they come to this show and think, OK, I would like to go to get tested. This is a resource for me. Right. We see programs like that, and we see that universal health care can and will lift up all people and provide more access, especially to people of color and queer people, if we provide that. So it's proven
exactly
to work.
Republicans are fighting against
exactly. Exactly.
In order to have equality, we need to have a health equality as a major component.
Oh my gosh. Universal healthcare would change the conversation about institutionalized racism in this mm-hmm. country, I believe.
I don't think people are listening. That's the thing that gets me, you know? Like, even my mother, she's like, oh, Pete Buttigieg, I love him. Mm-hmm. Or Joe Biden. And mm-hmm. people are like, stop speaking negative about Democratic candidates for president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, both Pete and Joe Biden, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, are both arguing that it's like, well, universal health care is going to be difficult. We need to, you know.
Well, I will argue with you there only because I have been following the 2020 election very closely. Yeah. Okay. And I think that it is what we need to make sure. I don't think it's that we need to not criticize any of our candidates, but I think we need to take a big step back and recognize that. When asked in the first debate about universal health care, right, every single candidate raised their hand. Now, they have different methods to go about that. Do we think that Joe Biden's method or something like Pete Buttigieg's method, which is like universal health care for all who want it, right? Do we think those will be right? Do we think it's a cop out? Do we think it's as effective as a plan as something like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren? No, personally, I don't think it's as effective. But I do think the fact that if we look at where we've come in the conversation about universal health care from 2016 until now, people were saying Bernie Sanders was insane in 2016 for even lobbying for universal health care. And now every single candidate has a plan that includes the phrase universal health care somewhere or Medicare for all somewhere in their plan. And I think we need to recognize what a blessing that is and how many wonderful candidates we have to choose from, even if we have our favorites and even if we have critiques for those who aren't progressive enough.
I'm tired of waiting. Mm-hmm. I don't want to wait anymore. I want to see Trump in jail.
Right.
I want to see a lot of these Republicans in behind bars. I don't want to wait anymore. I'm done with it.
Put him in jail.
You know,
lock
and
him up.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting, you know. And my friend Kirthy actually says this. She's a television producer. Sometimes it takes this just horrible monster to get people to realize what's important and what's valuable to them.
And I think that we are having those conversations. I think, like you said, the power of theater to change hearts and minds, right? And I think that one thing we were talking about the other day in rehearsal was, if my mother comes and sees this show, right? This is a woman who has maybe never had a conversation with a drag queen that she knows of, okay? Mm-hmm. But for this hour and a half, she will have to sit and she will get to sit and listen to the story of two drag queens, fictional or not, you know, and one of them is biographical in a way, and have to sit there and listen to them tell their stories. And that is huge. And that is why I think things like representation are so important, is because if you are not going out there and having those conversations on your own, then in the theater, we're going to make you have them.
Terry, Courtney Barringer, your uncle, you're the drag queen. You're sort of telling her story. Are there any queens from her community is like, that's not what Courtney said?
You know what? I would love to do the show in Albany. So that all of her
Albany,
friends
can, Georgia.
Albany, Georgia. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's where I'm from. And that's where the story takes place. I'm sure they would. I'm sure that they. But I don't see how that's possible.
Is there a drag bar? Is there a gay bar in Albany? Or do you have to travel to like Tallahassee? Because I was looking on the map. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Like the biggest place is like Tallahassee, I think, looks closer on the map than even Atlanta does.
There are gay bars in Albany. They're not like Sidetrack. But they're there. Unfortunately, a lot of them have closed down. I was just home and I was going to try to go to some of them. And my mom was like, this one's too dangerous. This one's gone. You know, can't go to that one. But yeah, they're there.
Now, neither of you have ever done drag before.
Oh, my gosh.
So
no.
This is the first time you've done drag.
We're
have
learning.
Have you done the makeup? Have you done the shoes and the wardrobe yet?
We have been practicing in our high heels every day in rehearsal.
Yes, I have done drag makeup mostly for this show because, like I said, it's been 2 years. Mm-hmm. So for like promoting readings and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've had practice with it, and sometimes I practice it for fun. I learn a lot from YouTube. Mm-hmm. Just today, I was watching Monique Hart give a YouTube tutorial.
She has the best eyes.
Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, thank God for YouTube. I feel like Monique Hart is my personal drag mother.
Well, and I went to a Life's a Drag party when I was a junior in college. I was so excited, and everyone told me I looked so bad. And so I've never done it since. I was really discouraged.
What I got did these you do wrong?
You know, I kind of got big old shoulders, and I was wearing a tiny little wig. I mean, I just didn't. I looked like a man in a dress, you know. Okay. But I'm really excited for my redemption in this the run of this show. We're doing our promotional trailer next week, so it will be our first time in costume and makeup. You can follow us at the Story Theater Instagram if you want to see.
Did you guys bring in an expert to be like consult?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we actually, yeah. Terry and I, before we even started rehearsal earlier this summer, we were lucky, blessed, privileged enough to sit down with Shea Coulee, and
former guest of this podcast.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
The reigning queen of my heart.
Right there.
Oh my gosh. She's everything.
Can we talk about her teeth?
Yes.
They're beautiful.
So
now they weren't when I knew her.
We love Shay. And
Well, Drag Race money will catch us a good chomper,
Shay was so gracious enough to sit down and talk to us and give us some advice, and you know, we've been corresponding. She's read the play, and then I just did finished understudying Ms. Black for President at Steppenwolf, and one of my fellow understudies was Cleopocalypse, and so she would give me
the tall one.
Yeah, she's gorgeous, and she would give me lots of advice and tips and stuff backstage as I was kind of like, hey, how does this, where do I go to, you know, where should we costume shop, where should we get our makeup, where should we, what kind of heels should I be getting, etc., etc. So we've had a couple of drag consultants, and we're really hoping that the drag community in Chicago will come out and see this show, because we want to go see their shows and support them, and hopefully they'll come and see themselves on stage, you know.
But Terry, I mean, don't you sort of like worry that you might look too much like a Rue girl? I mean, you're getting advice from Shea Coulee, right? So instead of what Courtney looked like at the time, in 2005, drag was very different than it was today.
Right. Yeah. No, because I'm not, I'm not going to be able to look like my uncle, and I'm not trying to, but also, I think that this show, as we are presenting it, takes place today. And so these characters are probably influenced by the Rue Girls a little bit.
Because I was telling you, when I went to see Miss Black for President, I was like, this better not be a Rue Girl production.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And I was show like, also,
I wanted classic drag.
Right. Yeah, this show also is not going to be like that either. I mean, this show...
We don't have the budget. Right, we don't have the budget for that.
I will say this for the show. The show is not about drag. The show is about these two people.
Yes.
And they both do drag, so you will see them in and out of drag, but if you're, this is not going to be Work the World Live. This is not, that's not what this is.
So you're not like laying in your coffin in full drag?
I am not, not yet.
Not yet. We'll see though, because of your idea.
I want to see a queen in a coffin, honey.
Coffins are expensive.
Survive, you can fill one. Ironically, you don't.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, we've talked a lot. This play is very timeless in a way, too. There aren't references to Rue Girls. Yeah. There aren't references to RuPaul's Drag Race. These are two characters that we are supposed to believe are doing drag with the little money that they have in rural Georgia, right? It is a very different scene than if you were to go to a Chicago club like Roscoe's or something like that and see a Rue Girl there. It's a very different scene.
Don't put these small town girls down, though.
We're celebrating it.
They put a lot of time and energy into their drag.
And so will we.
Mark and I just went to see a drag show, a drag pageant in Madison, Wisconsin. And
we
stumbled upon it, and I just felt like I was crashing somebody's party. You know what I'm saying? They were the audience was into the show, and the performers were like, it was very cliquish.
And so it was like, I sat down next to these women and just like, who are you guys rooting for? And they just like practically like hissed at me. Like, how would you not know that we're rooting for this person? I'm like, bitch, I don't live here. Okay. I don't know any of these queens up here on the stage.
I have the utmost respect for a Southern drag queen. And so, this
it's doing it in that heat.
In the heat. In the heat.
Because if it's not the shoes, it's the heat.
Right. Well, and I think that's so.
How many drag queens have died from heat stroke? I want to know.
When
you get heat stroke, you don't die right away. You die like 3 weeks later.
That's terrifying.
You mean I could just drop dead any minute?
When you get heat stroke and stuff like that, there's something, I don't know what it does. I think it shuts down your kidneys or something like that. But it does. That's why it's really dangerous for older people, you know, to be out in the sun and
oh my gosh.
Is the thought of me dying, Paul, funny to you?
Did I laugh?
Yes, you did.
maybe we'll write a play about it.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be nice.
At the Wake of the Dead podcaster.
Yes.
The heat stroke play.
The sequel.
One thing we haven't touched yet is the mixed race relationship.
Yeah.
Our friend Michael and Durrell say they're a black white gay couple. Mm-hmm. If you see a white guy and a black guy together, they're fucking.
Mm. Adults. Yeah. If you see an adult black guy and an adult and hanging out, they're also fucking.
Well, we're not having sex currently.
You and I know we're not.
No, we're not.
So
we proved
that.
Them wrong.
I actually was thinking that when you guys came into the studio, I was like, those two are fucking.
Oh no. We are both in committed relationships.
Was it a casting couch kind of thing at all? Or, I mean, because you put yourselves into the production, but you're also like making it happen.
Absolutely not. The Story Theater is a professional organization that would never have sexual harassment. Thank you very much.
Well, in terms of your interpersonal friendship, does that get questioned a lot? Does it come into play
or in real life?
Both.
In real life, no.
Because you're developing this as friends, you know?
Right. Well, you know, there are lots of folks in the room. So we are the ones who are lucky enough to get interviewed by this amazing podcast, but we have so many people in the room every day, right? Okay. So we've got our director, Michael Burke. We've got our assistant director, Ayana Bria Bakari. We have our dramaturg, Sydney Halliburton. We have our stage manager, Lucy Whipp, right? We have our understudies. So every day in the room, there are lots of people who are helping to create this play.
I think what I'm saying is that sometimes in our society, especially due to inequality and racism, is that we don't make space for people of different backgrounds to be friends.
Oh,
yeah. And so when we see them, you know, Michael and Durrell, they're sort of joking about this, but there is studies that have been done that LGBT people are more likely to be in an interracial romantic relationships than cisgendered and heterosexual people are.
I didn't know that.
But that makes a lot of sense to me, I think, because for cisgendered people, the way for so long that they have linked up and found love is like, I go to the watering hole here and you go to the watering hole here and your parents link you up together. And for queer people, we seldom have that opportunity. Like my mom wasn't ever looking to introduce me to young women. Mm-hmm. So
ever?
She knew.
Those
come
dreams
on.
Were dashed
she
to the
knew.
Young
yeah,
age.
They were dashed early. She walked in the room and saw me singing Whitney Houston and was like, fuck. but I think that for queer people, we have to go on a search to find what we like. I mean, I know growing up, the only examples that I had in media for queer relationships was Queer as Folk. And looking back at it, that is...
I'm so sorry.
Right.
I feel responsible for that.
I prayed and prayed like, oh God, I can't wait to get out of my parents' house and be a 25-year-old white gay man. So
And now you are.
And now I am. But I
you're in theater, you know, in Chicago.
Right.
That's a kind of a bougie thing. You know?
Ooh, is it bougie?
I think theater is very bougie still.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah. And you know
it's
what?
It's a privilege to be able to be in the creative arts in this day and age.
Right. I agree. Absolutely.
That's a great way to put that.
Yeah, 100% is. And that's so crazy to me going back to Hamilton because theater is so primal. Mm-hmm. It's something that we have been doing forever and it's fucking free. Like, this, you know, this is theater. It does sort of have this like elitist reputation in part because of Broadway, because Broadway has become so expensive in the past 20 years.
Hamilton tickets are still expensive.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I think going back to what we were talking about earlier, actually about access to the arts, you know, the most expensive ticket to see At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen is $15. Mm-hmm. The cheapest is 10, right? If anybody is unable to pay, but wants to see this show, they can email me and I would love to get them in for free.
You know,
free.
The way you do it, you say, the cheapest ticket is $50. And I'm like, Paul, that that's not good enough. And you're like, all right, 35.
No.
All right, 50.
No. Because we're a nonprofit organization. We're not interested in making a bunch of money from this. We're interested in changing hearts and minds and getting this story out there. And I think going back to your point earlier, if we're going to be having grand conversations about institutionalized racism and race disparities and stuff, but we're not cultivating those interpersonal relationships like you were talking about, mm-hmm. then I don't know how we're going to have those conversations. If you're not talking to Black people, how are you going to know what they would like to see politically? That seems silly to me. So,
well, best of luck, Terry Guest.
Thank you.
The playwright in residence of Story Theater and their co-artistic director, Paul Michael Thompson.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
The name of the play is At the Wake of a Dead Drag Queen.
Ooh, fabulous reading.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm available. It's running at right now, I guess. It opens
September 7th is our official opening, but we have previews September 5th and 6th.
And it continues to run
till September 22nd.
But, you know, you're going to have extended run.
Oh, I hope we have an extended run. That would be incredible. A sold-out extended run.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
You can't say it, though, until it actually happens.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you're right.
Because people will be like, I'll just see it next week.
No, right. Don't let them do that. Yeah, and folks can get tickets or read more about the show or about Terry or about our company at thestorytheater.org.
Yeah, also Instagram. My Instagram is Terry Explains It All.
Paul Michael T.
And then the Story Theater also has an Instagram. So please follow us on social media to find out more about the play, to see the promo video.
Yeah, we're a young company. So opportunities like this are seriously huge for us in expanding. And neither Terry nor I are from Chicago. So you're helping to introduce us to this scene. So we're really, really grateful.
Well, you're always welcome on Feast of Fun, huh?
Thank you so much.
Oh, yes.
Anytime.
I want to remind folks that we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to this show is what makes this show happen. Or you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun and get sneak peeks at behind the scenes on Feast of Fun.
Honey, you can Venmo me some money, honey, at Feast of Fun. And I'm sure Terry and Paul Michael will be happy to take a little tips.
Oh my gosh.
I take 20s. Terry, Guest. I take 50s. I take 100s. Anything less than 50, don't even.
Oh my gosh.
American Express will do nicely. Thank you. Yes. Would you like to hear my Venmo address again?
At Feast of Fun.
And Paul Michael Thompson, if people want to support the Story Theater.
Yeah, then they can go to thestorytheater.org/support. Every donation is tax deductible to the extent allowable by law, because we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we worked really hard to get that status so that any contribution that made can be written off on your taxes.
So if you stuff a dollar into the performer's...
Write it off, baby.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.